That's Laura.
Fell in love with a deep fake. Oh God, I fell in love with a deep fake.
That's French artist Latoix. The track, I Fell in Love with a Deep Fake. Welcome. My name is Duncan Trussell, and you have made the sacred decision to cross through a kind of portal into an alternate multiverse where you are now listening to the DTFH, the podcast that has received over 5 Stallion of Light Awards from the Schringender Peace Association. I welcome you. Today's guest is one of the most requested guests on this podcast. If you, like me, have some inexplicable inner thread of puritanical guilt because you desire things like PlayStation 5s and polyamorous foot jobs instead of longing for some austere mountain hut where you're eating bowls of tasteless oatmeal and chicken broth, then you're going to love today's episode because Mitch Horowitz teaches a powerful philosophy that invites us to examine our desires not as though they were some kind of crusty hell barnacle growing in the coral reefs of our souls, but rather the actual bridge that can connect us to who we truly are. I love it. It's okay to want a PlayStation 5. It's okay to want a nice car. It's okay to dream of one day laying on your back in some beautiful exotic location while your many lovers rub oil on your moobs and make you suck their feet. This is a glorious podcast, and we're going to jump right into it. But first this. A tremendous thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. My friends, right around the corner, we've got over 70 different gifting holidays, from Christmas and Hanukkah to Lord Nothnarg's Day of Selflessness, and you need to come up with an original, beautiful, powerful gift that's going to make you look like the Lord of all giving. And sure, you could, I don't know, go to the store and buy some kind of thing for somebody and bring it to them and wrap it up in a little box and they open it and then there's the thing and they're going to be like, wow, the thing! Or you could give them something that could potentially catapult them to global fame. And that's a Squarespace website. Just think about it. How many of your friends and family members have mentioned to you that they have some desire to start a small business or seem to have some entrepreneurial aspiration and they just need somebody like you to light their dream fuse and blast them into glory land? And what better way to do that than to give them the gift of a Squarespace website? Squarespace, it's easy. That's the main thing. It doesn't matter if your uncle has been living in some kind of survival bomb shelter underneath his farm for the last 3 years. He will be able to figure out a Squarespace website. You can make a website in seconds. Or if you want something complex and powerful and potentially mind-shattering if the wrong person looks at it, and you can see proof of that at DuncanTrussell.com, which is a Squarespace website. Squarespace gives you the tools to go as deep as you want, baby. You can crack the entire time-space continuum open with a Squarespace website, or you can just make a beautiful, simple template for your uncle or your grandfather, your grandma, your mother-in-law, your mother, your sister, or your brother that they can then update with whatever their particular businesses that they're wanting to get started. Squarespace, not only do they help you make great websites, but you can also use them to send out mailers if that's what you're into. And they've got all kinds of powerful technologies in there. They size to any device. They have shopping cart functionality. I'm going to say it again. I say it every single time because it's true. I know someone who makes a lot of money selling their socks online. And if they can do that, then surely you have an audience that is eager to buy your oil paintings or your custom-made aquariums or leather patches or awesome shoe remodels. So head over to Squarespace and give them a try. Go to squarespace.com/Duncan. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan and you are going to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/Dunkin'. You could try it out for free. See if you like it. See if it makes sense as a gift for one of your beloved friends, relatives, family members, neighbors, even a pet. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Dunkin' and you'll get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. And now, everyone, please welcome back to the Duncan Trussell Family, our podcast, the brilliant author, lecturer, and philosopher, Mitch Horowitz. Mitch, welcome back to the DTFH. It is so nice to get a chance to talk with you because I got a lot of questions for you today.
All right. Thank you, my man. Great to be here.
Your book, The Miracle Habits, it's fills me with a little bit of envy only just because, like, what, you just randomly put out a book? Like, when the last time I chatted with you, you just put out a book. But suddenly there's just another book. Tell me about how this came about.
I sit in front of the keyboard a lot. And I don't know. It's funny. I'm at a stage in my life. I'm turning 55 this month.
Congrats.
November 23rd. Yes. So it's I don't know if that's quite as much of a milestone as turning 50, but one does feel it in some way.
Yeah.
And I've reached this point in my life where there seems to be this weird sort of tipping point where I sit down to write something, and if I'm being honest and if I'm being sincere, a lot of accumulated material comes pouring out of me. I don't know that'll continue forever. Mm. You and I might talk in another year, and I'll say, oh my God, you know, I feel this crisis of content, of material. I feel like I'm faking it or something. I hope that day won't come. But at this point, when I sit down to write something, particularly in the area of self-development, a lot comes pouring out of me. Mm. And so that's how The Miracle Habits was born. And since habits rule our lives, and since habits can direct us into catastrophe, my contention is that habits can also direct us to extraordinary things. And so the book consists of 13 habits that I think can prove helpful.
And what's beautiful about a prolific author giving a prescription like this is that the proof is in the pudding. Whatever you're doing is working because you're shotgunning out books and they're good. That's the other thing. They're good. They're concise. They're smart. I was reading The Miracle Habits and I wanted to tell you about a weird synchronicity that happened. So,
please.
And also I want to engage you for some free self-development help, if you don't mind. I know it will make me seem like a greedy pig, but hey, what am I going to do? What else are we going to talk about?
I'll take it out of your skin later.
All right. Woo. Right, okay. Here's something that has been happening to me and it's driving me crazy. I keep losing my keys. I keep losing my wallet. I don't know what's going on. It's like really like annoying me. And so I lost the most recent thing I lost was my wallet. And I stopped for a moment. And I really was thinking of Neville Goddard. I really was thinking of like, okay, this, whatever this is it's got to stop. Like we've got to turn a corner. I'm a dad. I've got another son coming. I can't be losing my shit all the time. You know?
Yeah.
So I thought, all right, we're going to use this ridiculous, irresponsible moment of absent-mindedness as a catalyst to enter into a new dimension where I no longer lose my keys or my wallet. And I know that's not a big deal. It's not asking for a mansion. It's not, you know, all the other stuff I would like, an infinity pool looking out over the mountains. I want it. And I love how in your book you teach us, don't be afraid of wanting those things. It's okay. But
absolutely.
But before I get to that, I got to be able to keep track of my keys. You know, I'm not like a 9-year-old. So that's when I found in your book, moments into miracles. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and how I might be able to use this ridiculous, embarrassing moment of absent-mindedness to get into my future mountain palace with an infinity pool.
Yes. There's so much to unpack there. It's interesting. You know, I want to say three different things.
Okay.
The first is, as much as I've entered a deeply prolific stage in my life, and as much as I can point to extraordinary things in my life that I feel give me perspective from which to write about the miraculous, I also try to be really transparent in the book about the failings and weaknesses that I feel in my life, and not just in some sing-song bullshit way, like, today I lost my temper in traffic. But, you know, I will lay awake at 4 o'clock in the morning staring at the ceiling because I don't know the right way to talk to the, you know, energy company about switching my gas service or some bullshit thing that, you know, to another person sounds like some very minor, silly little detail of life. But for me, for various reasons, is loaded with emotional triggers. We all have them, and none of them have to be rational. They're just ours.
Yeah.
And so I try to be really transparent about the weaknesses that I also have, because when people who write in the space of New Age or alternative spirituality or self-development aren't naked in front of the reader, they're liars in two realms. You know, they're liars in their own lives and they're liars in what they're telling the reader. Right. So I try to be really transparent about that too. The other thing is, I do believe that small things in life, like finding lost keys, are very important. It's to add to your synchronicity. I actually lost my keys this morning and I found them in the bathroom where everybody should leave their keys. Just go right now and put your keys right by the toilet where they belong so they can get flushed. You know, I do believe small things are important because what we, and I try to make this point throughout The Miracle Habits, what you can do in a macro fashion, what you could do in a micro fashion, you could do in a macro fashion. Mm. What you could do on a small scale can be repeated on a large one, as above, so below. And so if you use some methodology to straighten something out that might seem modestly important, you're getting a scent trail, you're getting a hint, and you can use that same methodology, I think, on a larger scale.
Wow.
So it's actually, in a certain sense, if I had to wax philosophical, I could even venture the argument that maybe you're training yourself, we're all training ourselves, that when a lost keys or lost wallet, which do need finding, I mean, it's not so minor. I mean, you do need those things. It's important.
Yeah.
When those things are lost and found, and when there seems to be a certain method behind the finding, behind the success, it begs the question, can I now use that method on some larger scale, which the person, the individual, must experiment with? And then as far as your mountain fortress and your infinity pool and that kind of thing, I feel that it's profoundly important for all of us to be very frank with ourselves about what we really want and not to get put off the trail of that by someone else's decision, by someone else telling us that's superficial.
Yeah.
There's a story I tell in the book where I had a shrink, a good man, and I must say, you know, a really positive, good shrink, who asked me what I wanted in life. And I started to talk about all these kind of markers of success that I want. And I was very frank with him about it. And he said to me, but that's superficial. And I said to him, now look, you've known me for a long time, and you know that if I bring something to the table, it's something I've thought about, I've wrestled with. If I am telling you that these markers of success are things that I really feel, having considered the matter from different angles, are vital to my sense of happiness, accomplishment, selfhood, how can that, by any definition, be called superficial? I mean, we're calling it superficial because there's a book of quotations somewhere, or there's a set of translations of translations of translations of ancient spiritual literature somewhere that says we're supposed to do that. But that's someone else's decision. That's not my decision. That's not even your decision. It's, you know, by which I mean my peer group. that's a decision that really is just hallowed by repetition. And so I would say to the individual, and this is why I sort of push back against the people who complain about spiritual materialism and so forth, which I think is another one of these tropes that needs to be tested in each individual experience rather than just applied in a general way. If someone comes along and says, I want a beautiful new car, whatever it may be, that person may have profound reasons for wanting that car. And if you speak to that person about it, it's like unrolling a ball of twine, and you find that that ball of twine is attached to something very, very, very important. And I think we as a spiritual culture have got to get off of this trip of judging things as material or superficial or inner or outer. Everything functions as part of one whole, the way that the, you know, constituent particles of an element ultimately function as one whole. And I really think, as Neville teaches, desires are sacred. And I think that's more than just a pretty expression. I think that there's something very deep from within a person that bespeaks itself as desire, and that we make a very big mistake and we generalize when we classify a desire as being good or bad based on some ethic that is actually the product of somebody else's decision.
Oh, I love it. It's such a bitter feeling to have a legitimate, authentic desire for something, and then to have whatever your particular, you know, whatever spiritual fascist lives in your head, I don't think you do, but some people do, appear and shake their fucking finger at you. Like, no, 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 that's a trap. And it's like, but that's what I want. I want to get in the trap. I want that. And so I love, that's one of the many things I love about what you're teaching.
Feels, feels, put it on my tongue like the nectar from the nipple of an angel from heaven above.
Feels CBD.
This glorious heart thumper of an episode of the DTFH has been sponsored by the CBD Alchemists over at Feels. We're so lucky that Feels exists in the universe, because other types of CBD taste like you stuck your tongue under a Chernobyl rat's ass and let it spray its diseased blast all over your taste buds, but not Feels. Whenever I take Feels, I feel like I'm in some forest cathedral being administered a druidic concoction by a high priestess wearing a beautiful velvet robe and nothing more. CBD is wonderful. It helps with chronic pain, anxiety, whatever you might be struggling with. You should try CBD. Helps me sleep. I know many people who use it after a workout. One day, maybe I'll work out and I'll have to use it after a workout. If you're new to CBD, Feels offers a free CBD hotline to help guide your personal experience, help you with dosages, and if you're just wondering what it is, they will let you know. Feels is a company that recognizes that CBD is perhaps, they didn't say this, this is my theory, an extraterrestrial manifestation, something like a compassion tendril protruding into the time-space continuum. Again, they didn't say that. That's just my opinion. Feels works naturally to help you feel better. There's no high, hangover, or addiction. You can join the Feels community to get Feels delivered to your door every month. You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel anytime. Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/Duncan, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/Duncan to become a member and get 50% off automatically with free shipping. That's feels.com/Duncan. Thank you, Feels. I wonder if you could go into a little bit more detail about this holistic conceptualization of the self. And specifically, this is something I've been ruminating over, which is, where do I stop and where does the rest of everything start? You know what I'm talking about? Okay, great.
Well, dig this. You know, William Blake wrote, "Opposition is true friendship." And I really take that principle seriously, because sometimes it's when people insult us or fuck with us that we learn things and are open to things. And years ago, there was an artist on Facebook who called me outer looking. He said, you know, I'm outer looking. And I took it as an insult, because in spiritual culture, we all want to think in terms of essence and the higher and the numinous and the inner journey, you know. And if we're called outer looking, the implication is obviously that we're being superficial or we're getting attached to the ephemeral. And I understand that. And, you know, I got to thinking, you know, okay, you know, is he right? You know, am I outer looking? And I thought to myself, well, yeah, you know, he is right if you interpret what he's saying in the strictest terms. But if you keep unraveling the onion, it seems to me, and this became a real opening for me, this is all just artifice, this idea of higher, lower, inner, outer, permanent, temporal, material, numinous, personality, essence. You know, it's all part of one whole life. It's all part of one whole existence. Yeah. If one takes seriously the maxim, as above, so below, from Hermetic literature, or takes seriously the idea that the creator fashioned the individual in its own image, it stands to reason that there is a wholeness to life. And when we create these lines of demarcation, it's artifice. You know, where would one begin in the other end? You know, where does the numinous begin and the temporal end? You know, where would I draw that line? Where does inner begin and outer end? Where does higher begin and lower, you know, end? You know, a friend of mine used a joke vis-a-vis personality and essence. If I do something or I say something and I like it, you know, I assume that must be essence. And if I don't like it, I assume that must be personality. These are all, you know, I can't get my arms around any of this. You know, show me ego, show me it, show me super ego, etc. You know, and I began to feel this is all one thing. This is all one thing. Now, there are questions of, am I behaving violently? Am I behaving with reciprocity? There's a whole other, you know, issue there. And I take very seriously the question of reciprocity for the same reason that I'm describing, which is there's a wholeness to our existence. There's a wholeness to our existence. And I mean this. I want people to really feel, that they can take a break, that they can really take a break from sweating the question of whether something that they desire is somehow in sync with spiritual principles. You know, whether that might be a job or a money or a mate or something sexual or a car or whatever it is. Because again, you know, how do these lines of demarcation get drawn? And I can say from personal experience that I've met so many people within the alternative spiritual culture, as well as the traditional mainstream culture, however one defines it. But I've met so many people who would describe themselves very willingly as being on the spiritual or religious path. Yeah. And they are absolutely torn in two. They're torn in two by people telling them, you have to practice non-attachment. You have to practice non-identification. You know, that's the answer.
Yeah.
So they're telling themselves, you know, non-identification, non-attachment, or they're reprocessing their desires through some kind of perfumed language like, well, you know, thy will be done. If it's thy will, may I get this job and I'll use this job to help people. And it's like, if you're going to help people, whatever that means, you know, do so. But don't reprocess your desire through that as if it's somehow tricking the cosmic or tricking the higher mind or tricking God, that it's like, you know, yeah, I want that Mercedes so I can help drive poor children to the circus, you know, and whatever. I mean, so, I really feel that we as a generation and we as individuals have to test and verify, you know, these principles, because we wind up enforcing them, self-enforcing them, enforcing them on other people, I don't think they produce happiness in the individual. I think that the individual is capable of defining happiness for him or herself. I really do, and should not have that definition taken away.
I love it so much. And that sort of, I don't know, contortion, that twisted pretzel that can come from misunderstanding some of these spiritual teachings or correctly understanding them it feels like a life ruiner. It feels like some of these philosophies are inviting people into kind of a state of permanent disassociation, you know, like, yes. And that seems like the opposite of happiness. It's almost like a weird form of suicide or anesthesia or something, where you're supposed to, you know, the whole concept of the ego, you know. And I love that you suggest that there isn't a real difference between the ego and what some people call the soul. Is that what you're saying? That there isn't like this metaphysical biology? Because that is like if you were to draw a diagram of one of the ways that some spiritual paths break down the human being, it's you've got your body and all your organs, but then you've got your aura, you've got your chakras. Somewhere in there is the soul, and the soul is a pure, perfect, you know, mote of divine love. And everything else is going to cause you suffering. It's going to cause you pain. It's a misunderstanding, or a kind of like you being in a dream state as you go and try to get the Mercedes to bring the kids to the circus, because the soul only emanates love, only emanates, you know, all the whatever, Bhagavan, all the various like the things we like to put into italics, you know, generosity, kindness, discipline. But the ego is this all-consuming, all-devouring, life-destroying kind of black hole that needs to be somehow eradicated. And this produces a kind of living contradiction that I think makes people like harm themselves.
I agree. I think that I personally speaking believe that division is just man-made. It's just artifice. It's just something that we've written down, you know, albeit in various traditions, which is why it deserves attention. But, you know, we kind of write down this paradigm, determine that this paradigm is absolutely true, that it's a topographical diagram that cannot be changed, challenged, and doesn't require re-verification. And so we wind up with this sense of divide, you know. So there's the ego who grasps, who gobbles up things. There's the soul that's loving and giving. I don't know that any of this is true. I mean, all I mean when I say spiritual is extraphysical. Do we as individuals have an extraphysical existence? And I believe that the answer to that is absolutely and self-evidently yes. I base that on many factors, one of them being ESP research, for example. Academic ESP research has statistically demonstrated the anomalous transfer of information in laboratory settings. One can embrace it, one can damn it, one can use different terms, but in as much as statistics are useful for determining reality, we have seen in repeatable experiments, the critics always say, you know, none of this has been repeated. And it's like, I know they believe that. No matter how many, you know, citations I give them, they will no more believe these experiments have been repeated than hardcore Trump supporters will believe that, you know, a reasonably accurate vote has been certified.
Right, right.
Totally emotional. Can't be, that chasm can't be crossed. But in any case, we have statistical evidence of anomalous transfer of information in lab settings and have had this for decades. So, you know, marry that to a whole variety of other things, including neuroplasticity, for example, where thoughts alter brain matter. And you have evidence of the extraphysical. Where that evidence takes us is a whole other question. Does that mean when I die, I'm going to cross the river Styx and, you know, do this, that, and the other thing? I have no idea. Right. But it certainly suggests that you, the individual, have an extraphysical existence, which to me is what the spiritual is. And given that I have an extraphysical existence, I don't necessarily know that means, you know, I have what a 19th century writer might have called a soul. I don't know that means that I'm going to be reincarnated. I don't know that means that I pass through concentric circles of life, as we're taught in Hermetic tradition. But I also do believe, though, that the people who set these things down have profound insights.
Right.
They're on the path with us, albeit as historical eminences in our distant past. And it requires exploration by the individual in the here and now. But I wouldn't be strict. I wouldn't be strict about assigning meaning to or assigning a kind of a slot or category to different facets of behavior. The me that wants to lend a hand to somebody taking out their garbage versus the me that wants to have some shiny new object. Is one better than the other? I have no idea. Does one emanate from a different place? I have no idea. All I'm certain of is that we have an extraphysical existence. And I am certain, based on my own experience and based on being in community with other people, that we are here to be generative. We are here to be productive. That's not contradicted in any of our religious literature, and in many cases, it's affirmed. And I do not believe that the 21st century person can truly be happy unless he or she is moving in the direction of some sense of attainment, productivity, generativity. When those things are absent, the individual withers and feels terrible desperation.
Can you talk a little? Okay, so I think something to consider when we are looking at this kind of holistic idea of the self, which is like, and one thing I love that you just said is like, you need to check it out yourself. Just because there's a topographical map created by someone who maybe was awakened, showing a kind of landscape that has within it like an area called the soul, an area called the ego, or a superego, if you want to go Freudian or whatever the model is, you still need to investigate it. But this brings to mind something that we were kind of talking about before I started recording, which is that you were talking about how, you know, one of the things that people who are going to write do is the cabin fantasy. You go off into the cabin, yeah, in some sanctuary, in the hopes that you will be more productive. And when you were telling me about that, I was thinking, yeah, also, aside from the fact that that's probably not going to work, it's another way to procrastinate. If I'm going to go, so if I'm heading to a cabin to write, then now I've got to find the cabin, get to the cabin, get the time off to get there to the cabin, make the arrangements. And probably if I produce enough in between me and getting to that cabin, I'll never get to the cabin and will not be thrust against the problem of having to write. But what do you think that force in the universe is that keeps us from procrastinating, from being creative, from being progenitive? Because if we're going to like sort of throw away the map where there's this distinction between the ego and the soul, then that would obviously indicate that torpor, slothfulness, laziness, fear, cowardice, all the stuff that keeps us from being progenitive is also part of ourselves. And that's what, to finish this question, which is, what is that? Is that part of ourselves? Is that a sacred part of ourselves? What I love about the way you teach and what you teach is anytime I get into your writing, I feel confronted. I feel like you've ripped away all of the great tricks I use to keep me from manifesting the kind of life that I want. And somewhere in there, there's this sense of vertigo, or like, holy shit, I can't jump. Mitch, you want me to jump off this crazy diving board? I can't do it, man. And so maybe you could, can you talk a little bit about, you know, I'm talking about that molasses quality of the psyche, yeah, that slows us down, that makes us not create that thing that where we can't get out of the comfort zone into the place where we do, you know, but you know, start really working magic, if magic is the, you know, whatever you want to call it, co-creation of the universe with the divine, or the co-creation of the universe with yourself.
Well, I think there's a wish for safety, and a lot of times safety comes in the form of a kind of physical equilibrium where we're well fed, we are intoxicated to help with relaxation, you know, whether that means booze or weed or drugs or whatever, which I participate in too, zoning out in front of the screen or whatever it may be, you know, zoning out in front of social media. All of these things create a kind of physical equilibrium and safety. And that has its place. And I practice it as well. I practice avoidance of certain things because it gives me a feeling of safety. And that's not always a bad thing. You know, I mean, sometimes we avoid things that are really dangerous and problematic. And other times we get so sucked into this need for physical equilibrium that we eat ourselves to death, or, you know, we drink ourselves to death, or whatever it may be. But I think that within every person who has invested him or herself totally in the sense of equilibrium, there's something that they yearn to do that they have left behind. And that something is almost always going to mean giving up the potato chips, giving up whatever it is that you're binge watching at a given moment, and doing something. And so it's funny, in a certain way, I've gotten so conditioned and I've gotten so wired to work that I have the opposite problem. I mean, I seriously have difficulty relaxing, and I need to zone out sometimes. It's like, you know, I have to trick myself in order to do it. You know, it might mean, for example, I've been watching Orson Welles movies, and I really dig Orson Welles. He was a fucking maniac and just so brilliant and wonderful. And so if I'm watching him, I kind of get into him, you know, and I can kind of zone out a little bit, or I'll like blast music that I really love. So, you know, we all get into grooves and we all get into habits, but I do think that when people are in a habit of seeking safety and equilibrium, there's usually a sorrow, in my experience, in there, where they're not building the thing or writing the thing or going somewhere or seeing someone or doing something or making that phone call that they really may want to do. But we get so conditioned by sameness that we do tend to seek it out.
Okay, that's cool. It's just a hat. So basically it's another habituation. It's not like, it's not, you know, sometimes when I'm, right now I'm not, thank God, in that place, but anytime I've gotten really blocked, you know, and it's just more laziness, I'll start thinking like, well, maybe it's a demon or a spiritual curse or a force keeping me from it, you know? But usually what it is it's just, I'm not putting my ass in the seat and typing, you know, it's nothing complex. It's like,
sometimes just assuming the act is all that's necessary. You know, William James made that observation. You know, he said, look, we always assume that our moods determine our actions. But he said, you know, what if the reverse is actually true? And it's funny, I know this professor, clinical professor of psychiatry named Norm Rosenthal at Georgetown. And Norm and a colleague of his several years ago did a study based on Botox and mood. And they found that Botox treatments seem to be lifting depression, and they were able to institute, you know, various controls so that it was obvious that just the appearance change alone, if it was desirable, wasn't the factor. There was some other X factor going on. And Norm hypothesized that, and this is going to sound just ridiculous, but it's actually amazing. Norm hypothesized that one of the things that Botox does is it actually freezes and effectively disables the muscles that you use to frown. And he related that back to William James's observation. And he wondered if the actual physical disabling of certain mood expressions might in and of itself have contributed to a lifting of depression. That was just a hypothesis that he drew upon from the study, but it does comport with what James wrote about. And it's interesting. I don't have any final conclusions about it, and nor does he, but I do think that one should take seriously that performing the task can actually bring with it courage, for example. Instead of saying, gee, I have to screw up my courage so I can do something, the actual task itself can at least be observed to engender the emotion.
Well, you know, this, to me, it makes perfect sense. I mean, it's just, even if it's a really small act, doing an experiment like that, just holding your, you know, not slouching, smiling, simple things like that, yes, are a kind of a declaration of autonomy over whatever those habits or forces are that keep us in just frozen in a specific dejected state. I mean, I feel like that happens to people. It certainly has happened to me, where you get your heart broken, you have some massive disappointment, and you stay frozen, like amberized in that disappointment. So you hold your body the way when your body slouched down and as you were crushed by life, you just keep your body like that. Mm-hmm. And simply lifting up and smiling, it can have a powerful effect. Now, I want to jump in to your awesome 30-day mental challenge. And, you know, it's literally challenging in the sense that, and again, it's what I love about you, man. There's like things in, it feels like you've been looking in my window as my wife and I are like making love to Sean Hannity. We had sex to Sean Hannity the other night, Mitch. Do you know how fucked up that is? Like, I had sex with, she's pregnant.
That mental picture will never leave me.
Pregnant, third trimester, sex in front of Sean Hannity. And I'm looking, it's horrible. I mean, I really do think we might have like damaged the universe from that. Like, we did some kind of horrific ritual that the world, maybe it'll never be the same. But you, go ahead. What were you going to say?
This will never leave me. This image will never leave me. Right? Or your listeners. This is it. Sorry, everyone.
But I'm sorry, y'all. It was really a dark moment. But I'm looking here at your 30-day mental challenge, and one of the, and I don't know if this is part of it or if this is just part of your blog, but one of the things you have here is reject comfort media. Is that part of the challenge? Or is,
yes.
Okay. And I'm just going to read a little bit of what you wrote.
Sure.
We derive a visceral thrill and probably a dopamine rush from reading things that affirm what we already believe. This is especially true of emotional subjects like religion and politics. Opinion porn, if I may, delivers the same kind of repetitive thrill as binge eating. It provides the head-nodding jolt of seeing your imagined adversaries taken down and your team score another touchdown. We don't agree with Sean Hannity at all. It's more the opposite, hearing someone say things we don't agree with, but it's the same pathetic kind of high. And so you're saying in this 30-day mental challenge that we've got to stop, like turn it off, quit doing that. And why is that going to help me? Like, I know obvious reasons, like, oh, you'll feel better or it'll challenge you, but tell me how metaphysically this has some connection to me, like jumping into the part of the multiverse where I'm a bit more actualized or connected.
Yeah. It's a super simple program method that anybody can jump into at any time. It's linked up on my social media. I have an article at Medium on the 30-day mental challenge. You just have to write down a vow to focus on what is forwarding and advancing and all ambitions that are reasonably within reach, and attempt this for 30 days. And there are various facets to it. And I've been doing it with people and providing some commentary day to day. But the basis of it is this. I believe in very simple exercises. I really believe that profundity is experienced only in application. So if I say to somebody, you know, we shouldn't lie, you know, heads start nodding. Yeah, of course we shouldn't lie. I know that. Well, we all know that. But we only experience the depth of that statement when we actually attempt to do it and fail, and then we're thrown in front of all kinds of other questions. Or maybe we succeed, and then, you know, that eggs us on to all kinds of other questions. But in any case, the world is filled with literature about how to live well. None of us follow it. If we followed literature of how to live well, you know, all you'd need to do is just read Marcus Aurelius, or right, read the Beatitudes, or read the Tao Te Ching, or read the Gita. Take your pick. And we've been reading these things for centuries upon centuries, and they haven't changed the world. They haven't changed the world because we don't test them. We don't apply them. We think we do, and maybe we do for 15 minutes, and then we get up out of the chair and we go up out into the traffic of human life, and all of our intentions are immediately taken away from us. The malady of human nature is the certainty that because we nod our heads and agree with something, it somehow is applicable to my life. So I believe in very, very, very simple exercises. So simple that we're apt to write them off. We're apt not to test them. We're apt not to even make an effort for a limited period of time to attempt to apply them. The profundity is found only in the experience, only in the application, which may include failure. But my contention is that if we assert a sense of self-determination, if we assert a sense of self-selection, if we assert a kind of positive fortitude in the face of circumstances that can be sorrowful, depleting, we will learn something. We will discover something. And we may discover extraordinary change in our lives because we so rarely test things. We so rarely apply any of the ideas that we like to talk about. And ideas grow more and more complex. Our language and our vocabulary grows more and more complex. Our range of cultural options expands and expands and expands. And yet, what would that accomplish? You know, what would that accomplish? It's like flying up in an airplane and looking down at the ground and saying, wow, what extraordinary perspective. But then we get back down to the ground and everything is exactly the same. Right. So I like simple things because I feel that they at least goad the individual towards application. So that's what the 30-day mental challenge is about. I suppose that's why I'm attached to all this literature from New Thought, you know, all these kind of like supposedly simple books about the power of using your mind, because they render into popular language steps that so few of us ever take, ever attempt, ever really try in terms of using our psyches in different ways. And they're completely uncharted territory and yet also, you know, completely available.
This episode of the DTFH has been brought to you by the sweet, darling chefs over at HelloFresh. I love HelloFresh. If you haven't tried it yet, you really should. It makes me feel like I'm on the cooking channel because, like, you know when you're watching the cooking shows and they've got all the ingredients measured out for them in little ramekins? That's what HelloFresh is. It gives you all the ingredients pre-measured. That means no more getting back from the grocery store to make a special meal for your beloved only to find out that you left out some crucial ingredient or got too much of something. It really does help you prevent waste. And even better, HelloFresh has reduced their carbon emissions to below 25% of the carbon emissions of most grocery stores. So you're helping the environment. Here's something extraordinarily cool about HelloFresh. So far in 2020, they've donated 3.5 million meals. And you can help too with HelloFresh's Beyond the Box program, where you give nutritious meals to those experiencing food insecurity with just a couple of clips in the app. Go to HelloFresh.com/Duncan90 and use code Duncan90 to get $90 off, including free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/Duncan90. And use code Duncan90 to get $90 off, including free shipping. Thank you, HelloFresh. What you're saying about these like very simple acts, I saw this trainer talking about how, look, if you can run, you know, whatever, 8 miles, you know, start once a week or whatever that you think you can do, you're going to be sore. You're not going to want to exercise or run half a mile. And you can do that every day. And you're in the end is going to be so much better than you doing this thing, which I am guilty of, which is like, you know, finally I whip whatever the donkey of my soul enough so that it does whatever it is I'm wanting. And then I overexert. You know, it's like now it's like I'm going to train for a fucking marathon, or now I can't just run. You know, it's got to be like now it's going to be uphill for as long as I can until I feel like I'm going to die. And then I don't do it anymore. So I do love this very subtle, simple day-to-day activities that you're laying out for us. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, and I'm sorry, this is kind of jumping back in time. Earlier, you were mentioning the hermetic conceptualization of human existence as concentric circles.
Yes.
Can you talk about that for a second?
Sure. Hermetic literature, which grew out of the late stages of ancient Egypt, the generations immediately following Christ, it was kind of an amalgam of Greek and Egyptian thought written down in Greek. That's where the expression as above, so below is derived from. And one of the ideals in Hermetic literature is that we occupy these concentric circles of existence, and the absolute center of these concentric circles is what the Greeks called nous, or mind, this great higher mind or intelligence. Emerson called it an oversoul, and everything emanates from this ultimate sense of intellect. And emanates through these concentric circles. And we beings that occupy these various circles of varying distances from nous, from the center, are in our own sphere able to create in the way that this higher mind creates, although we are also restricted by the physical limitations that we experience. And I really love Hermeticism because it helps me to cope with some of the contradictions that I experience when I'm using the philosophy of Neville Goddard or of New Thought, this idea that mind is the ultimate creator. Because, of course, we experience physical decline. We experience mortality. Yes. There's never been an exception to that. And so we do live within these material confines that will not prove permeable to mind in the here and now. And when I mean the here and now, I mean I'm talking, you know, Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m., you know, I don't want to hear about an experience that somebody had when they were on vacation, so to speak. Like, you know, we've all had higher moments of sensitivity and awareness, but I'm talking about that which rules our lives in the here and now and right now. And Hermeticism would say, you know, this is not a failure to grasp something. This is just the nature of things. You are able to create, and your mind is able to generate. It is. Mm. However, you do exist at some distance away from the center. We don't know what distance, but these concentric circles that you dwell within all have their own laws and forces, and you're going to have to experience them. Over time, you may, through cycles of life, through cycles of recurrence, progress through these concentric circles, but every one of them has its own laws and forces, and you're going to have to deal with that. So to me, that was helpful in terms of my approach to New Thought.
I love models like that, that produce a kind of map because for me with New Thought, the part where my rational mind gets thwarted is the part where it's like, well, yeah, but I don't understand how, in a world where there appears to be limited resources, you know, you take it to the maximum, everybody adopts this way of thinking, and not only adopts this way of thinking, but fully like adopts it. Like, you know, when you read Goddard, this isn't the secret, man. It's the most psychedelic invitation to start remembering from the future, basically. And
yes,
that's wild. Cause it, you know, that, I think that's the place where I don't know how many people can walk with him into that place, because he's saying, no, you're going to just this. You really are going to have to give up a lot to achieve this state of consciousness. And if you do, you essentially, you do transcend. You do get past the limitations. There is no limitation other than you imposing it. So for me, yeah, these kinds of maps, the circle one I have not heard, but these kinds of maps work really well because they point to a multiverse instead of a single universe. They point to the possibility of leaping parallel timelines using your mind, that the mind becomes the navigation unit through which we move through the multiverse. Do you know of anything that looks at the world in that way? Like the Hermetic conceptualization sounds like it, but maybe I'm misunderstanding you when you talk about it. The idea essentially being, and we've seen the pictures of the alchemist like lifting up the curtain of the universe, you know, and just walking out.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
How literally are we to take these ideas? I mean, they really do point to the possibility of, like, if you wanted to, you could just pull the curtain up and say adios to this particular, whatever you want to call it, circle or sphere or whatever it may be. How literally are we to take these ideas?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think that Neville and Hermeticism, for me, those philosophies form the greatest mystical analog to quantum theory, to the illusion of time and space. And that's why I speak in terms of selecting versus manifesting, which is not a term that I use, because in terms of selecting, if perspective, and I'm really sort of encapsulating this into a very tight little marble, and there's so many other directions it can go in, but if through the measurement of the senses I'm experiencing something, it would necessarily bring with it a past, present, future, so that I don't have a sense of something changing. I have a sense of it always being this way, but I have selected it also in this. And so it's not as if I experience my selection as a before and after. I experience it as a complete naturalness, including what I call the past, including what I call the present, including what I call my expectation of the future, in the same way that if you make a determination to measure the locality of a particle in a lab based on the time of day you've taken that measurement, based on the decision to measure or not measure, you have effectively created a whole past, present, and future that would have been entirely different if you had taken a breath and done it just a moment later, which raises the question of serial universes and everything playing out at once. And so it totally tears asunder this whole idea of a linearity to life. But I want to touch on something you said, and I want to ask you a question, because you used a beautiful, beautiful phrase where we're remembering from the future. You know, if we're selecting an outcome, we're remembering from the future. One of the things I wrestle with in terms of that approach, and I think that's a beautiful way of encapsulating Neville, one of the questions that I run up against is this. You know, I was saying earlier, I was quoting Blake, opposition is true friendship. You know, I was talking about experiences I've had that have been fractious, that have been difficult, but have brought me to new places, have produced, helped me to produce things that I never otherwise would have produced. Sometimes I'm not so sure I want to erase opposition, as frustrating and as anger-inducing as it might be right now. You know, if I try to enter into some hypnagogic feeling state in which I turn bitter into sweet, let's say, is that really what I'm after? You know, because if I eliminate bitter, I've eliminated the very thing that may be refining me. I've eliminated my ability to relate to another person who's also suffering, you know? So I feel temperamentally, sometimes I'm not really sure that I want to, I know I want victory, but I'm not sure I want to eliminate bitter.
Oh, I love that. Well, I mean, yeah, I think from the way that you talk about challenges, it's just the way that you've conceptualized challenges. Odd, it doesn't make them unbitter, but it produces a space within a life where these things aren't necessarily an indication that you're doing something wrong. And mm-hmm. anymore, what comes to mind is like someone like complaining to an attendant at a gym because all these exercise machines are making them sore. You know, get rid of them. You know, the point is they're there for you to develop yourself, to grow.
Yes. Yes.
And so it makes me think of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and his description of imagine a child licking a razor blade with honey on it. You know, with the child in the full awareness of a child simultaneously feels the pain, tastes the blood, but also the honey. They're all there together. And yeah, you don't, yeah. you know, and so, yeah, I wouldn't want, I know what you mean. I especially when it comes to friendships where I disagree with my friends, I love that. I have friends yeah. I vehemently disagree with. I have friends who call me like a blue-bellied commie, you know, like QAnon friends who like, you know what I mean? They I know they think I must be part of some like global conspiracy or something. You know what I mean? And I love it because I feel like my very existence ruins their conspiracy because I'm not. You know, I just believe differently, and I'm so happy. What a sad universe it would be where there was no opposition, where we get rid of that, the joy of overcoming. It's so great.
Yes.
But, yes. you know, simultaneously, you run into a problem, which is you have to, like, make sure you're not getting addicted to the adversity. You know what I mean? For me, it's like...
Yeah, yeah.
Because sure. of my upbringing, I was taught that pain means success. You know what I mean? That if you're not suffering... to some degree, then you can't really be successful. And this produces like a workaholic attitude in me where I'll get up at 4 or 5 a.m. and start working, not necessarily because I want to, but because it will definitely produce a certain level of pain. You know what I mean? And I'm familiar with that. So I don't know, man. I think Goddard points in the direction of all the great mystics, and I think it's a little terrifying what he's pointing towards.
It is terrifying, and you know the what I love about Neville is he issues such a radical thesis to us, and he means it so literally. You know, he taught your mind is God, and I don't mean that in some metaphorical way, and I don't mean that in some symbolic way. I mean that quite literally, that you absolutely shape your circumstances. Everything you experience is your own emotionalized thought pattern outpictured. And I sometimes challenge people, and I think I read about this in Miracle Habits. What if you don't believe that? And what if it's not important that you believe that? But what if you just use that as an ethical exercise? How would it change your life? How would it change your day? If you really believed in Neville's challenge as though, without necessarily signing on to all the metaphysical assumptions that go around it or trying to rationalize it out, how would it change your day? How would it change the way you treat other people? Mm. And would you be able to do it? You know, would you be able to do it? That's the thing. People want to opine about the experience absence the experience. And so
yes.
I would say if it's intriguing to you, try it for 45 minutes and see what happens.
Well, don't you think the problem is it's like... God, it's the strangest thing. It's like if mysticism were some kind of vessel, it's a vessel where you have all these people lined up to get on, carrying all these big bags. And when they get to wherever you enter it, whoever's in charge of that gate is like, oh no, it's too much weight. You can't bring that in. This is going to take you to a place that you've always dreamed about, but you can't bring your PlayStation or whatever the fuck it is you're bringing. And people are like, no, I don't want to let go of these things. And I understand that. I think it's somehow wrapped up in the fear of death. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, because for, and maybe you have had this experience. Sometimes people like you, I wonder if you're careful about talking about some of the things that you have experienced because you don't want to confuse people. But, you know, I think for some of us, if we did adopt the methodologies of some of these people. And I don't think, you know, like the modern person reads the Hermetic stuff or reads some of the magical literature, reads Neville Goddard. and thinks, well, he didn't really mean that. He meant something more mundane. They didn't, you know what I mean? I know that sounds like he's saying we could instantaneously travel to essentially another dimension where we're essentially another person, unencumbered by all the ridiculous foibles and bad habits and debt and karma that we currently are encumbered by. But he didn't really mean that. Because if he really meant that, he would be insane. What he meant is that maybe in 6 months from now, if I set up a nice savings routine, I'll have an extra $800 in the bank account, you know, because don't you think that really the reality of it is that we're kind of, as much as we like to bitch and complain, we're kind of happy in our little pod. We're kind of happy in our little gooey section of the multiverse where we're not quite happy, but you know, we're okay. And we don't want to rip open time and space. We don't want to leap into that. Don't you think that that's the reality of things? Isn't so much that people are being thwarted by reality, but more that they have somehow connected this kind of transformation that you teach with death?
It's interesting. I think that sometimes being driven to your knees is the best thing that can happen to you, because it breaks us out of, or at least compels us on an experimental level to invite in some other possibility. And these possibilities, in my experience, are very real. And in as much as I talk about basic things, simple things, I do very much believe in applying the basic, because I think we neglect it all the time. We have no experience of it. We only think we do. However, I also do believe that, and I would issue this to everybody listening, you know, extraordinary things do happen in life. And in as much as our behaviors can direct us towards catastrophe, so can they direct us towards the extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And if you're feeling desperate, and if you're feeling needful, and if there's some situation in your life that has you absolutely feeling stripped of all resources and of all ability to feel at ease and at home with yourself, your very realization and admission of that, your willingness to do something to break yourself out of that, whether it means just a 30-second visualization or it means a prayer to some deific energy that you seek a relationship to, which I take very seriously, something could happen. And I implore people not to neglect that experiment, because there can be changes that occur all of a sudden. You know, I had some really weird, wonderful experience years ago where I was seated in a spiritual group that was dedicated to esoteric study. And I asked a question, and a senior member of the group was responding to the question. He misheard my question. And he spoke to something other than what I was talking about. But in the course of mishearing my question, he said, "There are no shortcuts. There are no shortcuts." And we all think we're supposed to nod our head in unison to statements like that. And I thought to myself at that moment, you're probably correct, but I don't know that. And you don't know that. How do I know there are no shortcuts? How do I know? You know, there can be all kinds of things and possibilities that occur, even if they're not necessarily repeatable. That doesn't mean they didn't occur. So I also want people to feel that extraordinary changes can occur and really may occur. The miraculous, by which I mean an unforeseen and fortuitous departure from all expected circumstance, that does occur, or we wouldn't have the word within our language. That does occur in as much as catastrophes occur. And I just want to say that when people are faced with circumstances that have them feeling absolutely desperate, I say without any sentimentality, that could be the greatest moment in your life, because the willingness to identify, wish for, pray for, visualize, affirm, whatever you want to do, whatever you want to call it, meditate upon, chant for, a change could bring that change. I've experienced that, and I can't fathom that my life is exceptional. None of our lives are exceptional in the sense that they're disconnected from one another. So I just want to encourage people to believe in the possibility of the extraordinary in the plainest sense.
Oh, Mitch, you are the best. Thank you so much. You always, I don't know how it always lies. I really, like, if anything gives me the eerie, swooning, slightly schizophrenic sense that maybe there is an Illuminati, it's you, man, you know, because, like, always just when I'm needing data, we end up podcasting together and it just lines up perfectly. I think a lot of people feel that way about you. So on behalf of them, I say thank you so much. And on behalf of me, thanks just for your time. Can you tell folks where they could connect with this 30-day challenge and also maybe let them know that it does, they don't have to like exactly be on the 30 days, or just tell people where they can find you?
Sure. The best way to connect with it is on social media. I'm on Twitter at Mitch Horowitz, Instagram at Mitch Horowitz 23. In both bios, there's a link, which I'm just going to leave up there, that goes directly to the 30-day challenge. You can start it at any time. Don't sweat it. I do issue commentary each day for this particular cycle, but if you want to find the commentary, I hashtag 30-day mental challenge. That'll connect you to the commentary. Jump in anytime. It's super, super simple, and you should be assured that there'll be other people doing it with you. So whether you are directly in contact with them or not, you're not doing it alone.
Okay, awesome. You know, I'm going to start a section in our Discord server where we, the DTFH folks, do this, because I'm going to start today. I think our conversation was the beginning of it. Mitch, thank you so much. When I finally shoot up with this delightful vaccine, hopefully we can see each other in person.
Yes, for sure. That would be amazing. I look forward to it, man.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
That was Mitch Horowitz, everybody. Make sure you go to MitchHorowitz.com and dive into the beautiful rabbit hole that is the Horowitz Connection. Also, much thanks to our sponsors, Feels, HelloFresh, and Squarespace. Thank you for supporting our sponsors, because by supporting them, you support us. I will see you next week with Connor Habib. Until then, I love y'all and happy Thanksgiving.